And I'm excited about this one. This one's going to be hot. This one's going to be, well, let me just say, bottom line, it's going to be raw. Uncooked.
Uncut.
And on something else, yeah.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is suggested for the following World Wrestling Federation event.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 147. Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, for the third time, I think it is, I'm going to be covering an edition of WWF Raw, this being Monday Night Raw from April 5th, 1993, which is, I guess, technically the night after Mania Raw. But back when it was WrestleMania 9 and this is the first year of Raw, things were a little different back then. There was no live edition from Las Vegas or whatever arena they would have had it. I guess it would have been the Thomas and Mack Center back in those days. Oh no, this is at the Manhattan Center just like the rest of them. But if you're thinking that they went from Nevada on the Sunday and flew back to New York for a live Raw the next night, oh, you would be mistaken. And this edition is a rather peculiar, odd, and still somewhat wonderful edition of Monday Night Raw. This would be the 11th episode in the series. But before I get into the show, let me get into my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. You may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and you can listen to all the other great shows on the feed. Days of Thunder, Bigfoot Pro Wrestling Podcast, Military Industrial Suplex, and of course, Worldcast. But it appears, per the Twitter, that their schedule is going to be cut back quite a bit due to some internet issues for the next couple of months. So we're all going to have to just sit tight as they head towards 1984 in world class. I got to say, though, also the World Cast of Champions being cut back because of the Hidden Gems. Obviously, I'm as upset about that as everybody else, because that's what I'm in for the network, is for stuff like that. And also, you know, for pay-per-views, for background research. Did I watch WrestleMania 9 before I'm recording this little intro bit? No, I haven't. The same as when I did the episode of Mania from May of 93. I was thinking about, am I doing too many 1993 WWF shows? I think the reason for that is because they had a lot of one-hour programs at that period of time, because you got Challenge, you got Superstars. Challenge is still relevant. You got Raw, which, you know, is just starting out, so it's always kind of interesting. You still had All American on the weekends, which I don't know why I haven't done an All American from 93. It's like kind of a golden time with Mean Gene and Heenan. I'll probably do that about 10 or 12 shows from now. I think just, you know, as we're now a week before Christmas, or slightly less than a week before Christmas, I was doing some shopping over the last week, and going to the malls. There are these two big malls near to where I work, and it occurred to me, a kind of a sad reality, one of those getting old sort of deals, like, oh yeah, you've put yourself on Nexium, but there are other little things that you realize you're getting old. One of them being, because I don't have any kids, I have absolutely no idea what is going on in, like, preteen culture, like age 9 to 12. Like, absolutely no idea. I walk into a store, I see Fortnite, I have no idea anything to do with Fortnite at all. Sure, I can tell you, you know, house show results from the Boston Garden from like February of 1986. But God forbid I know anything, you know, to do with what my niece and nephews might like. Other than, luckily now, my nephews are at an age where they have an Xbox, and I can go back to when I was a 10-year-old boy, and what I want was, I would want a video game. So, I just go pick out something for Xbox. Of course, what has to complicate things is one of the boys likes hockey more, and the other likes basketball more. So, it seems pretty simple. You get one of them NBA 2K20, and they get the other one NHL 20. Except, the NHL, or Electronic Arts, or whoever, they've decided to make that game so difficult to find that I had to go to like a third-party affiliated vendor through Amazon, which I'm not particularly crazy about. I've also checked in the stores, and it's been very, very difficult to find. It's particularly bothersome to me that like the NHL should be doing everything they can to promote themselves. And I guess, I don't know, I'm just going to hold out hope that the game is actually good, and that's why it's sold out. I don't even know if they have Madden, and those games are so complicated. And I'm not looking forward to when I go down to Long Island on the 25th, as per tradition from the last 2 years, going to have to play my now 9-year-old nephew in Madden 20, I guess it would be at this point. Now, I have a 1-1 record against him the last 2 years, and basically all I do is run the ball like I'm a service academy from the 90s or something, and just keep that clock running and hopefully, you know, force a couple of turnovers because he tries to do things on offense that aren't necessarily smart. So that's a couple of weeks away on the 25th. I probably won't have that in time for the show that airs the next day, but I'll probably have something the following week. I don't know which team I'm going to be. I don't like to pick a team that's too good, but I'm also not going to pick a terrible team because I want to give myself a chance. I think I picked Dallas last year, figuring, well, if I have Ezekiel Elliott, my plan of just running the ball all the time will certainly work. I would pick Tennessee, except for the fact that they probably have Marcus Mariota as the default quarterback, and I don't want to have to figure out how to change any of that. So, looking forward to Christmas, but I'm looking forward to way more than that is getting my snowblower back, because every time I hear that there's going to be snow, I'm just absolutely holding my breath and praying that it's not anything that, you know, can't be shoveled too easily. But in the meantime, I got that 1993 WWF, which apparently I am in love with because I've done way more of shows from that year than I ever thought I would. And they tend to be more earlier in the year is what I've noticed. Now, this show I watched back in April right before I headed down to WrestleMania in New Jersey. I was sitting in the basement in the morning watching this one, and it really just kind of caught my attention. For one reason is it's actually on YouTube. Shh, don't tell anybody that this edition of Raw is on YouTube, okay? We got to keep it a secret. So I watch this, and I get in the car and drive 4.5 hours down to New Jersey. So as I said, it's impossible for this to be live because they, for whatever reason, they were not going to fly everybody back from the West Coast. They actually had tapings out there for Challenge and Superstars the nights after WrestleMania 9. And Raw was not on the level of Superstars as an A show in 93, even at this point. It fits in somewhere between Superstars and Challenge. Challenge probably is now a C show, and Raw is kind of like the A-, B-plus show, I guess you could call it. There's also some changes for Wrestling Challenge around this time, as Jim Ross took over. He debuted at WrestleMania 9, and then he takes over at the first Challenge after WrestleMania. So the one that aired on the day of WrestleMania 9 is the last Gorilla and Bobby show, which Gorilla is sporting a WrestleMania 9 t-shirt that I swear to God is like painted on. I mean, couldn't they have given him better, something a little bit bigger than like a men's large? I mean, you know how big Gorilla Monsoon is. It's just absolutely insane. But yeah, that's actually their last show together, at least to my knowledge. I don't, maybe unless they teamed up for a one-off somewhere later before they have that whole feud that leads to Gorilla literally kicking the brain out of the building. But on this show, as I said, there's some oddly delightful things. I mean, we get a Damian Demento match, for God's sakes, which just be, this is so 1993. Jerry Lawler is in action, and it's interesting because it's the first match that he had on weekly television in the WWF. Yes, he was in the Royal Rumble, and he had house show matches, but this is the first match that he had on weekly TV. He's doing Superstars as the commentator at this point. The Bob Backlund 1993 Bizarro series continues, where you have Bob in there in like these weird matchups that don't seem like they that they seem like they're just really, really weird. It's got nothing to do with Bob Backlund's kind of oddness, like he's completely from another era. He's taking on Kim Chi in this one. I mean, who decided, all right, Backlund, go out there. You're facing Kim Chi. But we do have a name match between two tag teams. The Steiner Brothers taking on the Beverly Brothers. And we're going to kick it off with Bam Bam Bigelow taking on Virgil. Now, this is all taped on March 22nd. So there is a little bit of room between this and Mania. So the commentary is interesting, because, you know, they're there in the arena and that they're at ringside, but you have to think that they dubbed it in afterwards in terms of like kind of the match commentary. But there's also at the same time a lot of interaction with them and the crowd. Like, for example, when we get to Jerry Lawler's match later in the show, there's a little run-in between him and the Macho Man. So with all that in mind, why don't we just get right into the show?
What a WrestleMania just last night from Caesar's Palace, one of the greatest WrestleManias of all time. And the last time you saw this man, if you watched WrestleMania, he was wearing a macho toga.
I really can't get past the time-traveling aspect of this, because he's talking about something that happened the day before, but is not going to happen for about 2 weeks after he's actually saying it, because he's not standing in front of a green screen, Vince McMahon, in the Manhattan Center. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm just missing something here. As our hosts are Vince McMahon and the Macho Man, Randy Savage. No Rob Bartlett. We're going to hear about that a little bit later on. And this struck me very much as a Vince and Savage just test driving the two of them so that they could write Rob Bartlett off, and that would actually happen shortly thereafter. So, it's one of those 2020 hindsight things, I believe. So, up first, as I mentioned, we have Virgil taking on Bam Bam Bigelow. Now, Virgil is wearing the black and white striped tights, the long tights, where it really makes him look like Dangerous Danny Davis, which is probably not boding well for his future prospects. Although, with that being said, just like Coco Beware in 1990, he had a better record on house show matches than you might have imagined for the year 1993. So, Bigelow, he comes out, and Savage lets slip that Hulk Hogan is now the WWF champion, which it's funny because Hogan wins the title. That match wasn't even scheduled, and Bam Bam had his match against Kamala cut for time, and then it aired on the May 8th edition of Mania that they ended up taping a little bit later. I covered that several episodes ago.
What a spectacle! The glitz and the glamour was only overshadowed by one thing.
Yep.
A new World Wrestling Federation champion.
A taste of the old
at the
Here's
same time. The yellow and the red Hulk Hogan is once again on top of the mountain. Barring an investigation, of course.
Bam. I'm actually glad Savage brought it up at that moment, because it gives me an excuse to not talk about how much I hate Bam Bam Bigelow's theme, because it's not the smooth jazz theme. But imagine, put yourself in the shoes of somebody watching in 1993, a casual viewer, and like, this is how you find out, oh, the winner of the Bret Hart versus Yokozuna match was actually Hulk Hogan at the end of the day, and he's the champion again. I don't remember watching this in real time. I would check in on Raw from time to time when they were in those early Manhattan Center days. Of course, my initial thought when I used to see it was, why are they having it there every single week? Like, what happened to the good old days of Superstars when they'd be in this arena that would look much more giant than, you know, they made it look so huge in those intros on TV that I'm quite fond of posting. And the Manhattan Center, well, I just didn't understand the magic thing. Now, New York City, they love them some Bam Bam Bigelow, and he shoves Virgil down right away. And then Virgil goes and grabs an arm. And when he goes to run the ropes, I notice Virgil's running it very casually, like he hasn't had his meat sauce that day or something, but he does score with a drop kick. And the crowd does not like this one bit, as a rather large and vocal Virgil sucks chant happens as we get some arm work, because people just don't appreciate that his mat-based style in the year 1993, I guess. But he's running the ropes again, and he's trying to do that move where he slides between Bam Bam's legs, and he just gets stuck there. He got caught on like a glue trap, like some sort of insect. A falling headbutt by Bam Bam misses, and Virgil gets a roll up for two. I mean, this match is really kind of hilarious at the very beginning, just because of how the crowd is turning on Virgil, despite, I don't know what he did. I mean, there was nothing overt about his Virgilness at that point. None of the stuff we know about him now was seemingly known then, unless it was like a local New York thing. Who knows? A crucifix attempt by Virgil, and Bam Bam counters it with a Samoan drop, which if you weigh 395 pounds, you should probably do that at all times. Then Bam Bam grabs a chin lock to give Vince and Savage a chance to talk about the other stuff going on. But Vince, I mean, he's really pumped from WrestleMania. There's the famous story of when Hogan is celebrating with the title, Vince emerges from the gorilla position and runs out and gives Hogan a big heartfelt hug in the middle of the ring. So apparently, he's feeling a little bit too much euphoria. He's gotten back with the old girlfriend or boyfriend, depending on how you look at it. They're having great sex again, making up for lost time. I metaphorical sex, of course. And now he's gonna overstate the case for WrestleMania 9.
There was so much going on yesterday at WrestleMania, unquestionably. That WrestleMania, I believe, will go down in the annals of history as the greatest WrestleMania of all time.
Hear that, everybody? Take that, WrestleMania 3. Vince McMahon believes that WrestleMania 9 was better than WrestleMania 3. It's so absurd, but it's so hilarious to hear him say it. WrestleMania 9 is not, I don't think, one of the worst WrestleManias, at least in the bottom five, is what I'm saying. I mean, it's eminently rewatchable. There's some interesting things on there. You know, it's peculiar matchups. You know I'm fond of those. And you get the debut of Jim Ross. It's kind of interesting. Even if that commentary team with him, Heenan, and Savage never really got out of first or second gear, because they seem to be colliding with each other. As you would expect for a team, you're going to debut them on the first show of the year. I think it's kind of a strange decision, I think. But I guess they wanted to make an impact with having Ross debut in a toga, I guess. So you got more Virgil sucks chance. And we get a reminder that Lex Luger attacked Bret Hart at the WrestleMania brunch beforehand to kind of give Bret an out against Yokozuna, in spite of the fact that I don't think him being attacked in the morning had anything to do with him getting pinned by a really fat guy after a salt in the eyes, but hey, I guess they just want us to connect those dots. As Rob Bartlett is stuck in Las Vegas, is what they tell us, so I don't know, who knows, we may hear from him a little bit later. I really don't care. I defended him when I did that 1993 Raw many episodes ago, episode 60, do check that out in the archive, but I don't think I'm going to be, I don't really want to defend him too much, because he is one of the worst parts of these early Raws, because his jokes just sort of fall flat, but I should save my thoughts for later. Virgil gets caught in a head vice, and his arm drops twice, but that will not pick up the win for Bam Bam. So he goes to the bear hug, and this is now turned from like hilarious to just out and out crappy. Virgil's arms drops twice again, but then when Bam Bam goes for a charge in the corner, Virgil gets a foot up, a clothesline, and then a missile drop kick by Virgil. He's bringing out all of the repertoire to try to win over these fans. Two count for Virgil. And this one's a little bit too competitive. Bam Bam's giving too much offense to 1993 Virgil, if you ask me. Now, Virgil comes off the second rope, does that thing where he runs in and he's going to jump back with the crossbody, but he misses, just like Jacques Rougeau used to do. And a headbutt off the top rope finishes, and Bam Bam finally wins this match at 6 minutes and 59 seconds. Now, I'm not saying he should have squashed Virgil in a minute and a half, but 6:59 is a little long. But then again, Virgil in 1993, I could not believe this. It was his highest winning percentage year in the WWF. And it's like I said, he's racking up victories on house shows the same way Coco Beware was in 1990 that I referred to on last week's show. Mostly house shows against the likes of Reno Riggins, Terry Taylor. Although, actually, now that I think about it, given that we know some things about Terry Taylor and his thoughts on people and their skin color, I'm kind of glad Virgil was going over Terry Taylor on a nightly basis. There's a morsel inside your head, tasted by the red. A burger would touch the thing. A Whopper from Burger King. You can't talk it off the teeth when you're crying out the thing. We'll cook it up special, have it any way you please. So when the stomach rolls like thunder, we'll satisfy your hunger. It's a Whopper from Burger King. Go away. I figured that Burger King ad from April of 1993 was appropriate because we do have Jerry the King Lawler up next, and he was serenaded with the chant of Burger King by the Manhattan Center crowd on this night. I saw a tweet about a week ago, and I can't remember who it was, so apologies if that person is listening. And they were kind of, it was one of those, let's gather, who do you think are the top five wrestlers of all time combining in-ring work, interviews, and character, like the character that they portrayed. And to me, since I'm a little bit less on the in-ring work than a lot of people seem to be, there seems to be an awful lot of emphasis on, you know, guys who can do moves. But my point is, Jerry Lawler has to be in that top five, no matter how you slice it, because pretty much everything he did in Memphis is eminently memorable. Yes, in the ring, it's not like he's having five-star classics, but he's having great stuff with Gilbert, Dundee, basically all the way down the line. All the people who came through Memphis, they met up with Lawler at one point or another, whether it be Hogan, Sid, Undertaker, when he was Master of Pain. So you consider interviews, here's Lawler almost on a weekly basis talking to the same local audience and managing to be relevant for as long as he was. And the character, you know, the king, yeah, there were other guys who were the king, but he's kind of the definition of what the king gimmick is. I often talk about the phases of my fandom, where early on, when I'm like 8 or 9 years old and I'm just reading the wrestling magazines, Jerry Lawler was just a guy who was somewhere else. Like, oh, here's this guy who's in Memphis and he's the AWA world champion for whatever that was. Like, okay, so he's the champion of the guys who are occasionally on ESPN, even though I don't quite understand how their TV worked at the time. Then, late 90s, he's the announcer in the WWF. So, his in-ring work was, I guess, I don't want to say it was de-emphasized, but it's not like that was made a part of the grander Jerry Lawler story as I'm watching it at that point. And it's not like I could watch Memphis because I wasn't tape trading or anything. Now, with YouTube, God bless, you can watch whatever Memphis episode. If you want to call up a Memphis episode from 1979, you can. If you want to watch one from 1989, you can. If you want to watch one from, 2001 Memphis Championship Wrestling, there's an episode in there that I really have to do because it has Daniel Bryan in it. And oddly enough, he looks almost exactly the same then as he does now from when he showed up at TLC. Anyway, point is, my appreciation for Jerry Lawler has only grown over time. Much more appreciative than this Manhattan Center crowd who, like I said, Burger King chants, something nice, something simple, maybe help WWF get a Burger King sponsorship out of the deal. I mean, hey, is it any worse than that weird Kentucky Fried Chicken thing that they had the other night where, oh yeah, we're going to set up this table and have a bunch of people eat a bunch of fried chicken at ringside, hopefully not get the shits, and then we're going to put somebody through the table later on. So Lawler, he's got a microphone, he's very upset with these Northerners and the way that they are treating him.
First of all, let me say something to each and every one of you imbecilic idiots. I am the king of wrestling, and I am used to being treated with respect. When I walk down that aisle, you idiots should bow down and kiss my feet.
They're saying Burger King, I believe.
If I hear one more of you idiots call say Burger King, I'm walking out of here.
Well, what a whopper.
You hear what I said? If they say Burger King one more time, I'm out of here. I mean it. I'm not going to wrestle if you keep that up.
Look at this.
Hey, that's it.
This
that's
is
it.
New York.
Well, oh, don't tell me. Are you kidding me?
I know I just expressed my love and admiration for Jerry Lawler, but when you look at his WWF run as a wrestler in the mid-90s, awful lot of focus on kissing my feet, a lot of foot stuff going on. I haven't seen anybody that obsessed with feet since Tony Atlas back in his heyday in the mid-80s. So anyway, off he goes because he's disgusted and he's not going to take to the ring. So we go to the back again, where Mr. Fuji and Yokozuna are standing by, and let me just say that they desperately needed Jim Cornette as part of this act. He's not going to be there for another 3 months as the United States representative, but Fuji is just not cut out at this particular point in time to be doing promos for somebody that you are pushing at a main event level. But luckily, we got Mean Gene Okerlund there, and I often talk about Lance Russell, not to go back to Memphis again, but Lance Russell, some of the time when the person couldn't or wouldn't cut a promo, Lance would kind of do it for them, kind of walking them through it. Well, Mean Gene Okerlund, in his last months here in the WWF, he definitely has still got it. And he has a much better understanding, I think, of contract law than Mr. Fuji, who clearly did not take any classes in contract law at the School of Hard Knocks or wherever the hell he went. He was much more interested in shitting in gym bags. So Mean Gene's going to kind of walk us through what's going on.
Mr. Fuji filing a formal protest with World Wrestling Federation President Jack Tunney on behalf of Yokozuna, claiming he should still be the World Wrestling Federation champion, notwithstanding his defeat of Bret the Hitman Hart. You claim there was never an official contract between Hulk Hogan and Yokozuna. You state the match wasn't even sanctioned. Jack Tunney, you've got a tough decision to make.
As much as I hoped for Jack Tunney to make an appearance on this show for the second consecutive week after his announcement of the Warrior versus Hogan main event of WrestleMania 6 on last week's show, unfortunately, we're going to have to wait until the weekend TVs because he's just not ready to make a decision the night after. And with the way that this was taped, there's no way we're going to hear from Jack Tunney at this point. So we're going to go to something else that is completely different, completely weird. It's Bob Backlund continuing his bizarro tour of 1993. Facing off against Kim Chi. So it's because Kamala's a babyface. Kim Chi needs something to do. So we're going to put Steve Lombardi, I believe it is, I'm reasonably certain of this, under the mask as Kim Chi. And it's going to be him and Bob Backlund. It's so crazy. Oh, and our referee is Bill Alfonso. I wonder if 911 could be the second official outside the ring or something. But Backlund, when he comes to the ring, it's a little weird to start out with because he doesn't have any music. And there's nobody quite like that. But he always has this confused and puzzled look, like this is the first time he's... It's almost like he's that guy from Pleasantville when he actually walks into the color, like from black and white. That's what Bob Backlund feels like. Or he's like unfrozen caveman lawyer or like Encino Man. Like, oh, he comes out to like, huh, what's going on? What is all this applause? These people, they're putting their hands together. It's so crazy. Also crazy is the fact that the loss to Razor Ramon the day before at WrestleMania 9 was his first pinfall loss in the WWF. Because, of course, it was a submission loss to the Iron Sheik with the throwing in the towel. As I said, Kim Chi is Steve Lombardi, and who ignores the handshake offer from Backlund, as just about everyone else would do. And Kim Chi's mask is very, very similar to Mr. Wrestling 2. I don't know if this is some sort of tribute mask, but I guess, yeah, it's always something that Kim Chi had had through the years. As Bob is avoiding contact with Kim Chi, it is just frustrating him, who heads to the outside. And as Bob kind of reaches out for him, Kim Chi gets in a cheap shot and then back inside a slam by Chi. Like, Chi is his last name, like Kim Chi. I don't quite understand the name. Like, I know that Kim Chi is like food or something, but every time I hear that, I think of O-Peachy, which is a brand of hockey cards. They were basically the Topps cards, but with a different logo on them, and part of it would be in French. I don't even know if they're even still made. I haven't even thought about hockey cards in like 10 years, except for that one year that they came out with referee and linesman cards. I have that complete set. I bought it a couple of years ago. Vertical suplex is avoided, but then Bob eats a back elbow. And I'm thinking, clearly there's no great plans for Bob Backlund in 1993 other than just put him in weird matches and have him eat a lot of offense from the former manager of Kamala. You get a chin lock. And then I think, yep, this is definitely Steve Lombardi. This kind of dynamic offense, it could only be one man, as an arm drag gets Backlund out of it. Irish whip by Bob, and he puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. A sunset flip by Kim Chi. I cannot believe that I actually wrote that phrase down here. The sunset flip, I'm sorry, it's a babyface move. Why is Kim Chi doing a sunset flip? I don't understand it, but Here's a better question. I know I said it was Steve Lombardi, but I'm going to let Savage and Vince discuss. Who is Kim Chi?
Kim Chi and Bob Backlund going at it here on Monday Night Raw. Down to the canvas. Who is Kim Chi? What's he look like, Randy Satin?
I have no idea, but I heard somebody saw him without his mask, and they said that he is too raw for Raw.
Too raw for Monday Night Raw.
Better with the mask on than with it off.
I don't have a clue where Savage was going with that. He's too raw for Raw. So you're saying, okay, his face is too raw? Or is it an oblique reference to it being Steve Lombardi? But if it is, you'd probably make the joke that his ass is too raw. I think I'm just projecting, thinking of Gorilla Monsoon and all of his references to that effect over the years. As Vince and Savage, they talk about the debut of Luna Vachon the previous night at WrestleMania 9. Kind of opposing Sherry Martel in a feud that wouldn't really come to be because Sherry would be out the door a little bit later in 93. And Luna Vachon ends up alongside Bam Bam Bigelow. It is strange to think that she debuted with Shawn Michaels and not Bam Bam, because you'd think of her being with Bam Bam all along. A back suplex by Bob. He's letting All Japan know that if they want to bring him in to have some weird, screwed up matches with like odd combinations of people, he's more than willing to make the trip across the Pacific. He's done it before for New Japan, and he'll do it for the other promotion as well. Kim Chi misses some elbows, but then he goes for a monkey flip off an Irish whip, and he puts his legs up in the air. I'm going to leave that alone as well. And Bob just kind of stops, looks at it, grabs the feet, and kind of cradles back into that pinning combination with the bridge that you would see on Championship Wrestling's intro from 1981. And that is how Bob Backlund picks up the win over Kim Chi in this just profoundly weird match that I didn't know that I needed until right now.
Yes, there it is, the WrestleMania Hotline. Where you're going to get special interviews, where you're going to get all of the results. You're going to hear about the double doink. You're going to hear about the happenings involving The Undertaker and Giant Gonzalez. What a matchup! You're going to hear an update on the condition of Sensational Sherry, the Hitman Bret Hart, the Hulkster. It's all there for you on the hotline. 1-900-909-9939. We'll be right back.
Missing from all of those WrestleMania 9 updates is any information about Damian Demento, who is up next against Jumpin' Jim Brunzel, still hanging around here in 1993. This is because Damian Demento was not on the WrestleMania 9 card, which I guess is fine. He was the only pay-per-view he was ever on was the 1993 Royal Rumble. But there are actually a few things interesting about him, starting out with the fact that he's got one of the all-time great kayfabe hometowns. It's under the Sid Vicious from anywhere he damn well pleases category. Howard Finkel would announce him as being from the outer reaches of your mind, when in reality he was born in Long Island, New York, which I find it odd that they just write Long Island, New York. It's like, it's a long freaking island. It takes you 3 hours to get from one end to the other, and that's like without traffic. So, you know, is he from Wading River? Is he from Mineola? We don't know, but he was born Long Island, 1958, just like my father-in-law, apparently. And he main evented the first edition of Monday Night Raw opposite The Undertaker, which you'd think would be his claim to fame. But oh no, 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 no. Damian Demento, real name Philip Tice, is also an actor, and he happened to be in one of my favorite movies of all time, and that would be Die Hard with a Vengeance, which I commonly call Die Hard 3. He was the guy with the gun at Yankee Stadium who was asking if he should shoot Samuel L. Jackson, but the guy who was in charge told him not to because McClane wasn't there. Rather fascinating, because I don't know, I like that movie better than the original Die Hard because there are more elements within it that are funny. But hey, this is a wrestling podcast. Nobody wants to hear me talk and wax poetic for 5 minutes about Die Hard with a Vengeance, I can assure you. So they get Rob Bartlett on the phone from Nevada, and so what's his excuse?
Hello, Rob.
Vince.
Rob, where are you?
That's why I want to know. Where are you?
I mean, we're here doing the show. You're supposed to be here. Last week you didn't show up. You were at Monday Night Raw last week.
I was there last week. There was nobody else there. I was all by myself. And they told me you were out in Vegas. So I went out to find you in Vegas, and you're not in Vegas.
Well, I mean, no, we're not in Vegas now. Obviously, we're on Monday Night Raw. Why aren't you here?
Why aren't you here?
Your timing's a little off, Bartlett.
We understand you had a little bad luck at the tables, as it were.
I have no more money.
Beg your pardon?
I have no more money, Vince.
And what about credit cards?
What are you trying to say, Bartlett?
Are you up to the limit there, too?
Your paycheck you gave me, it bounced.
It did? You
well,
shouldn't
no,
try.
I didn't. I blew it all.
Uh-huh.
On I those see. 99-cent shrimp cocktails?
Yeah.
Rob Bartlett had zero comedic chemistry with Vince McMahon on this show, at least that I can remember. Maybe there was a funny bit here or there. I don't know. I guess it was kind of funny that one show that he was imitating Vince the entire time, but I don't know. I mean, like, you had Bobby Heenan right there, but you weren't going to use him for this because, oh, we got to use Bobby on Challenge. Just a real head-scratcher when you really think about it. As Jim Brunzel thinks he is in some sort of time warp, he thinks he's back in the AWA, so he just grabs an arm and goes to work. It's like it's All-Star Wrestling from 1981, and Damian Demento puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for, I guess, a ring veteran. I mean, he had wrestled as Mondo Clean since 1987, on the independent circuit for what that was at the time. Small package by Brunzel gets a two count out of that. And then a sunset flip. It does not get the pinfall. You know what? Maybe I should just talk about Die Hard with a Vengeance, because it's far more interesting and I care about it far more than this freaking Damian Demento versus Jim Brunzel match. The whole movie, okay, the chemistry between Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson throughout it, the tension between those two guys. Of course, the scene where he has to wear the sign with a racial slur on it because the Jeremy Irons bad guy, Simon, wants him to do all these things, and then Samuel L. Jackson saves him. Now, there are a few inexplicable things that happen in the movie, but I'm going to forgive them. One of which has to do with Damian Demento's character eventually chasing them down when they went up the aqueduct. What I don't understand is, when they go to drown McClane, and he comes up through the aqueduct, how do they know that he's going to end up there? That's one thing that I never quite understood. Like, how is it that Samuel L. Jackson, Zeus, happens to be right there when he comes flying out the aqueduct when they had tried to drown him? And wouldn't they have thought that they had succeeded in drowning him? a little bit too much of the bad guy, you know, the Austin Powers thing. I'm going to plan an overly elaborate and slow death and just assume that it worked the plan. A lot of that in the movie. But when you get to the end and Jeremy Irons and McClane, I mean, you know what? I should just play like 90 seconds from the movie.
Here, take this. How's it work? You know how to shoot a gun?
Look, all brothers don't know how to shoot guns, you racist motherfucker.
Sue me. Just yank back on that and pull the trigger. That's it.
That's it?
That's it. Just don't shoot yourself.
Don't fucking move. Oh, the Samaritan. Give me the goddamn code. Code? Oh, me for the school. I'm sorry, I can't do that. You call in that code right now, or I blow your sick ass into the next world. That's what you gotta do. Gonna take safety catch off.
Oh, God!
See, that works. Now, where's my plane? Hello, John McClane.
There was never any bomb in school, was there?
Of course not. I'm a soldier, not a monster. Even though I sometimes work for monsters. No, the real bomb is on this ship.
Coast Guard. I was telling him where the boat was. Game over, huh?
Not quite over. Bridgeport Coast Guard, come in, please. Did they put you on hold?
She told me to stay on the line.
Oh, God, I love this country.
You know, your brother was an asshole.
He was an asshole. You got his number.
I'll never forget seeing that movie in the theater and the part where the FBI guy is telling McClane that Hans Gruber's brother is the one chasing after him, and he has the flashback of Hans looking up as he's falling off Nakatomi Tower. And I just remember a dude in the theater getting up and yelling, "Holy shit!" I love stuff like that. Stuff like that, and the time I saw the Blair Witch Project when people were actually throwing trash at the screen at the end because they were so angry at how that movie had concluded. All right, and that ends the Die Hard with a Vengeance talk, at least for now, at least until I get bored with another Damien Demento match. And by the way, the crowd is chanting boring at this one. I mean, poor Jim Brunzel, there's not much he's going to bring to the table at this point other than his dropkick. Vince does say the WrestleMania replay will be the following Monday on pay-per-view, so they're cannibalizing themselves. Miss Monday Night Raw so you could order the replay of this pay-per-view, which is being totally oversold. One thing about Damien Demento, I don't quite understand what the character is. It doesn't seem fully defined. Like, what exactly is he? What is your inner Damien Demento? I need to know a little bit more. Anyway, we get a comeback from Jim Brunzel, which isn't amounting to a whole lot until he lands that beautiful drop kick off the Irish whip. And when he goes for the pinfall, Demento does get a foot on the rope. And a reversal of an Irish whip, he gets kicked in the gut. And a sort of neckbreaker rude awakening type thing is Damien Demento's move. You think, okay, well, go for the pin and that'll be it. Instead, he does a standing knee drop, and that is how the match ends. So Damien Demento picks up the win on Monday Night Raw, but to me, he will always be the guy at Yankee Stadium who didn't shoot Zeus in Die Hard 3.
To be the World Wrestling Federation champion, you gotta want it every day. It takes an integrated approach to training, and that is what ICO Pro is all about.
Chip! Ah! Gotta have beef, gotta have spice, need a little excitement. Snap into a Slim Jim. Oh yeah!
Sneaker tamer insoles from Odor Eaters. Tame even ferocious sneaker odor with the world's most powerful odor destroyer.
I got to rewind it there to the ICO Pro because they're using Brett with the world title, which fine, that's okay. He only lost it the day before. And the other Ico Pro ads that you see are Luger, of course. There's a Scott Steiner one. I wonder what all these guys have in common. But interestingly, you never see Hulk Hogan associated with Ico Pro, with the exception of the one interview that he did in February, where it was just the sit-down between him and Vince, like kind of like the one pre-WrestleMania 8, thank you for Hulkamania. And Hogan is wearing an Ico Pro shirt in the February of 93 Raw, where he's doing that sit-down. Other than that, no association, which probably a decent idea to keep Hogan away from it while he's pushing now a fifth demandment of believe in Hulk Hogan. I feel like there was some inflation in the Hulk Hogan demandments over the years. We had three for so long, and then he was just tacking them on willy-nilly. So Jerry Lawler's music plays, and he comes out for part two, and he is met once again with Burger King chants. So he just leaves once again. And this is actually a pretty nice build where, okay, I kind of want to see what happens with all of this, because Lawler, I guess, understands the law of three when it comes to comedy, so now something's going to happen the third time that he comes out. Vince promotes the WrestleMania 9 replay on pay-per-view the next Monday, and earlier I had stated that it's kind of weird that the pay-per-view would be going right up against Raw. Well, that being said, Raw was only an hour, and they clarified on the following week that after Raw, I actually watched the edition the week after, just to kind of give myself a little bit more clarity. And Vince said yes, the replay of the pay-per-view would be after. Also appearing on the next week's Raw in various roles are the Steiners and the Beverly Brothers, and they are up next against each other in a Royal Rumble 93 rematch, it seems. And I was thinking about the Steiners and how they're all over 1993 WWF, and just, like, it's so incredible how that did not work. And I was trying to figure out, was it the schedule? Was it because they wouldn't let them go to Japan? It was a little bit of everything. Also, a big chunk of it is Steiners, I think, were kind of ill-fitted in the way that people say that Arn and Tully were ill-fitted for the WWF, which I don't think applies. Because here are the Steiners, this like stiff as hell team that plays well in Japan, but in 1993 WWF, it just doesn't, it really doesn't make a lot of sense in that context. It certainly didn't have anything to do with the way the WWF presented them. They weren't presented as clowns. They still had the bright colors that they had in WCW. So I don't think you can blame that. I just think that maybe they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, just as simple as that. And because they were so stiff, you had somebody like a Mike Enos, who was the only person who could take the Frankensteiner particularly well. And hey, he's Blake Beverly, and he happens to be in this match. Wonder why they kept working with the Beverly Brothers again and again. The Beverlys had a kind of a weird little run here, because I'm glad that I watched the following week's Raw because of the Beverly Brothers' kind of odd face turn that occurred where they had an argument with Money Inc. backstage. This leads to a match between the two of them the week after, which Money Inc. actually wins. And then Wayne Bloom, a.k.a. Bo Beverly, disappears, goes into semi-retirement. I don't know what semi-retirement means. I mean, either you are or you aren't. Yeah, you come back every so often on the independent scene, or I guess he turned up in Herb Abrams' UWF at a certain point when that was near the end. Mike Enos, Blake Beverly, he sticks around because he's the personal job guy of the Steiner brothers, and he's also a very cromulent professional wrestler. But Bo is the one who actually starts out here. And he is opposite Scott, who starts with an arm drag. And Bo complains of a hair pull, which exact same start to the Bret and Shawn match from the last episode. Scott then grabs an arm, takes him down. And again, kind of, we have that hair complaint again from Bo Beverly. And this now, this exchange is actually leading somewhere, because now Bo gains an advantage by actually using the hair to take Scott down. When Scott was not using it, Bo was complaining. Now Bo is going to use good heel tactics by Mr. Wayne Bloom. Then he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. I feel like I'm seeing this an awful lot on the show. And Scott hits that double underhook suplex. That's kind of like the Pearl River Plunge, I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen an Ahmed Johnson match, so I don't think I'm going to dive back into that anytime soon. Blake Beverly does get tagged in. Eventually, Scott does make the tag to Rick, because that's how we work tag team matches here in the United States. If one guy tags out without any pressure, the other guy is going to tag out, because that's the way we've organized this damn thing, damn it. So Blake has a brief advantage in the corner, and off an Irish whip, he hits a 6 out of 10 Ted DiBiase power slam. But then he misses a clothesline on Rick. It's not a Steiner line because it's, you know, his name isn't Steiner. But then he gets caught, Blake Beverly, on a leapfrog into a Ted DiBiase-style power slam. I only give that 4.5 out of 10 from Steiner. It looked a little bit loose and sloppy, which happens when he does that spot where he catches a guy on a leapfrog. Scott is in, and he holds up Blake Beverly. And almost kind of like a high bear hug position, like you're going to do a Rougeau bomb or something. But instead, he does an overhead belly-to-belly suplex. So Mikey is taking all of the Steiner's big moves. But then the Beverleys regain the advantage with the Bret Hart Memorial transition spot.
He's not fucking dead.
My worst fear is that I do that bit on a show and then Bret Hart actually does pass away before the show is released. I'm going to feel really bad about that. For those of you who are among the uninitiated, the Bret Hart transition spot is the knee to the back of the face team as they are running the ropes towards the side where the heel team guy is standing on the apron. So They get a little bit of an advantage and get a leap. That move that the Beverleys would do where Scott is kind of draped throat first over the top rope and then a leapfrog one Beverly over the other to kind of clothesline him on the top rope. So Scott is our face in peril. We get a side backbreaker by Bo Beverly as Raw goes into a commercial, but they did not say that Raw rolls on or anything. So kind of more, I guess, natural back at that time. There was a tag from Scott to Rick, but the ref does not see it, so we're doing that thing. And a bear hug by Blake, which I'm not sure how that's going to work, but a vertical suplex is blocked. Although Scott didn't do that thing where he kicked his foot forward to block it, because that works, because it's professional wrestling. Scott does get the vertical suplex, but they're still able, the Beverleys are able to hold Scott on their side of the ring, but a reversal of an Irish whip leads to a tilt-a-whirl suplex by Scott, because he is just a master of all manner of suplexes. I guess that's how he and Taz bonded in 1995. Scott finally makes a tag, and now we get Rick Steiner and Blake Beverly in there, a big backdrop, and a clothesline, but the pin is broken up. Excuse me, he actually called it a Steiner line, Randy Savage did, but the pin is broken up. And Bo tosses Rick to the outside. And this is where things get very, very fuzzy, because the Steiners did not make tags. It's almost like an AEW match. Yes, I know the Steiners are never going to work AEW because they're too old now. Well, actually, I'm not going to rule anything out at this point. Stranger things have happened. But, they could abide by, I guess they're trying to tighten up the tag rules in AEW is something I read recently. But in any event, we end up with Scott Steiner and Blake Beverly, Mike Enos in the ring. So, of course, you know what happens.
Now, who's the legal man?
I can't call it, but here goes the Steiner brothers.
Whoa! There's the Frankensteiner. Cover one, two, count of three.
They got him.
What a victory.
Now, that was all kind of set up with the Beverleys doing the end of the WrestleMania 1 main event spot where they're holding Scott. And one of them comes off the ropes, I believe Bo, and he accidentally hits Blake. So then that's how Scott and Blake end up in the ring by themselves together. So yeah, Scott Steiner hits the Frankensteiner on Blake Beverly because he's the one guy who could take it. It's just the personal accommodation here reminds me once again of baseball and how certain pitchers just do not want to pitch to in most cases, the starting catcher on their team. The Red Sox famously had knuckleballer Tim Wakefield and Doug Mirabelli for years and years. Back in the day, Steve Carlton, the Phillies, and then the Cardinals had to pitch to Tim McCarver, the only person who wanted to hang out with Tim McCarver for 3-hour stretches at a time. Greg Maddux and Paul Bacco, or was it Eddie Perez? I think it was both of them at periods of time. Anyway, that's Scott Steiner and Mike Enos. They are just like those guys.
Hi, I'm Todd Pettengill. Join me every weekend for WWF Mania.
It's wild. It's crazy.
It's excessive excitement caused by acute hyperactivity.
Each week, we'll bring you exclusive interviews and tons of great wrestling action. But most of all, it's just good, clean fun. So start your weekend with the outrageous WWF Mania. Saturday mornings at 10 Eastern on USA. Just, brush your teeth first.
I discussed this back in episode 138 when I covered WWF Mania from May of 93, but they really cared about that show for the first, let's say 4 or 5 months. I mean, it was pretty much nearing the end of the point where they actually paid attention to that show. I mean, they're actually advertising for it on Raw, and they actually started on the same weekend. The Mania started on Saturday, the 9th of January, and the first Raw was on January 11th. And this goes for, like, all WWE shows through the years. So the one that comes to mind the most, even though it existed prior to the time frame that I'm going to refer to, is Main Event, because that aired on, like, PAX or some weird network that really nobody watched on Wednesday nights. And then they put it on the WWE Network live on Tuesdays at its launch. And it was interesting because here's this second live show that's not Raw, that's only 1 hour. So right up my alley. So of course, in the year 2014, I watched Main Event all the time on my phone, like every single week. We got a Shield versus the Wyatts match 2 days after WrestleMania. So they actually had good stuff on there. So it's you know, good to look at stuff like that, like shortly after it comes out. But up next, we have Jerry Lawler, part three, because the rule of comedy, as I mentioned earlier, you got to do everything in threes. And if there's anything that Lawler should be offended by this New York audience, it's not them chanting Burger King, because when you call yourself the king, you know, you're going to get stuff like that. It's people, like, grabbing his robe as he's coming to the ring. It was really, really strange. Like, there's one security guy, and he ain't doing jack shit to, like, stop anybody from doing anything. Yeah, there's a guardrail, but, I mean, people are just reaching over, touching his robe, grabbing it or whatever. They posted on Twitter earlier this week the video of the Boston Garden theme song, the WWF Onescence song that I love so much. And 26 seconds into that, Hulk Hogan has to shove a fan who basically grabs his white American-made shirt, because it's clearly 1985, there's no Hulkamania shirt on him, and he only wore the American-made, I think, in 85, grabs the shirt, and Hogan, like, turns around, stops, and shoves the person away. And this is all captured in the video within 2 seconds. It's hilarious. And Lawler's dealing with a similar thing here. And as he gets down to ringside, he just seems to be nonplussed and doesn't want to get in the ring. And we have no idea who his opponent is on this day. But all of a sudden, attacking from behind is the ghost of Survivor Series 88 past, Jim Powers of the Youngs, formerly of the Young Stallions. I mean, geez, that's 4.5 years in the rearview mirror. It's funny to think that Paul Roma is a member of the Four Horsemen around this point in time. It's a little bit after this, granted, because it's April of 93, but here's Jim Powers still in the WWF. He probably should have gone somewhere else for a while, but hey, you know, we live with the decisions we've made. He runs Lawler into the ring post. That's a disqualification in the AWA, but not here, as Lawler does take a powder on the outside. And I am pleased to report that I've expressed my admiration for Lawler's work, but the tights that he wore in the 1993 Royal Rumble were an absolute joke because they looked like kids' pajamas. It was absolutely just mortifying to watch him in there with, like, Tenryu, Flair, Mr. Perfect. And it's like, here's this guy who's wearing, like, children's pajamas for tights. But, hey, you know what? I'm going to give him a pass on that. It's not as bad as the Shawn Michaels Brown from Survivor Series 02. I mean, that kind of takes the cake for bad gear. That and the Aleister Black I Just Crapped Myself outfit from the other night. I think it was maybe on the pay-per-view or whatever it was. He's facing Buddy Murphy. Powers gets a hip toss and a slam, and then Lawler goes back outside. He just hates the chant, and Lawler does that I hate what the fans are chanting thing as good as anybody. Paul Orndorff was very good at doing it when they would chant Paula at him, but Lawler, he might be the very best at that. And I was thinking, I don't know if I've actually covered a Jerry Lawler match. I've done Memphis episodes. I guess the end of the hair match with Austin Idol in the cage, but I don't think that was the full match. Certainly, I don't think I've had Lawler in an enhancement role, because I think he's just done promos in the Memphis shows that I've covered. So it's something a little different and interesting. And he's giving Powers an awful lot of offense in this one. Powers just hits him in the face. And at this point, Randy Savage, his commentary at WrestleMania 9 didn't make a lot of sense at times, such as they're hanging from the rafters of the Roman Coliseum. Oh, wait, we're outside. If there were rafters, they'd be hanging from them. Well, here, I don't know where the hell he's going with this.
He cannot concentrate on the matchup. They're driving him nuts here on Monday Night Raw.
From now on, he's going to have to travel with a psychiatrist, and at $9,000 an hour, that's going to get expensive.
I don't know why a psychiatrist would have to cost $9,000 an hour for Lawler. That didn't really make a lot of sense. And Vince just kind of blows off the joke, pretending as if Rob Bartlett had said it. One of the funny things about the later stage Rob Bartlett episodes is the fact that Vince just kind of ignores and no-sells every single joke he makes, with the exception of the following week when he's sent out there to interview Luna Vachon, and all hell breaks loose between Luna and Sherry Martel. And by the way, a lot of clothes come off in that fight. I suggest you take a look at that, because there's some very, very interesting, weird, wild stuff on the next week's Raw, which I probably should have just covered instead of this one. I don't know. Maybe someday I'll cycle back to it. Backdrop by Powers, but then he misses on a dropkick. So now finally Lawler will gain some measure of control. He yells that he wants Powers to kiss his feet, so there we go with the foot thing again, and works him over for a bit with a classic Jerry Lawler fist drop, and he's talking at Randy Savage outside the ring, which is causing me to have flashbacks to 1984 Memphis, when Savage was the invader and Lawler the local hero.
Bottom line, he's good. Now we gotta stop him.
Biggie's talking to you again.
Was he talking to me?
I don't think so, no.
Was he talking to me?
No.
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking to? You talking to me?
Savage and Lawler are such a natural feud. They're both announcers in the company. They have a history going back, so it certainly appeals to me, who likes to create cross-promotional feuds over many years in his head. Even though I probably didn't know all that stuff back in those days, even if I was watching the product in 1993. Lawler then runs into a boot in the corner of Jim Powers. And the crowd does not care about Jim Powers firing up at all, because he's just done too many jobs over the years. I mean, he's been there since like 1985, 86, somewhere in that ballpark. Maybe even 84. I can't remember, but I mean, we're talking like a full decade here of him never above a jobber to the stars or a very light push level. He then puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, and I feel like that's the millionth time I've seen that on this show. Lawler hits an elbow to the head and then just decides to go ahead and hit the pile driver, because we're not in Memphis and it's not instant disqualification like it is in the state of Tennessee. But the best part is, even though Lawler hits his finishing move, he still pulls the tights on the pin. That's a real nice heel touch, and why Lawler is one of the greats. And he didn't even have to pull down the strap either for this one to fire up. So the King, Jerry Lawler, it's a shame that the feud with Savage didn't really happen in the WWF, because he goes on to Bret Hart at the King of the Ring, which is a natural thing for them to do, because Bret had won the King title and Lawler is the King of Wrestling and all that. But Savage and Lawler, they resume their feud in Memphis in late 1993 during that McMemphis angle that I adore so much. And I should probably just do a show on at some point, but like I said, there's so much footage out there. It would probably take me two shows to cover it all, or I could just do a late 1993 show from the USWA and get one of those Vince promos as part of it. Now, Lawler, he hasn't had enough here. I mean, we're talking two of the great talkers in the history of professional wrestling. Lawler and Randy Savage. Now, Savage, he's on broadcast, and he's not that good at it, quite frankly, at least when he's there by himself with Vince. When he had Piper to play off of, I think he worked a lot better. So Lawler comes over, confronts the Macho Man, and I'm trying to take a guess, you know, as a fan, pretending like, okay, we don't know the history of these guys from Memphis, like, well, maybe I'll take a different piece of Savage's prior history and say Lawler has a problem with Savage because he was calling himself the Macho King from 89 to 91. Is that it?
You know, you Macho Man and all the rest of this scum from the Rotten Apple are right where you belong, sitting nice and comfortable in a little chair watching the greatest wrestler in the world in the ring. It's easy for all of you to run your mouth when you're sitting in your little seat. All of you gutless wonders, the only thing that's athletic about any of you is your feet. And that goes for you too, Macho Man. You don't have the guts to get in the ring with the real king. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, I guess we couldn't have a Macho Man versus Lawler feud in 1993 because the Macho Man was just tied up in other stuff going on, like fighting the Repo Man to get his hat back on a earlier edition of Monday Night Raw. It's so ridiculous how, like, they, like, so determined they were to not utilize him in any way other than a broadcaster until you get to the Crush thing at the end of the year. Yes, he takes part in the Yokozuna. Oh, my God. Did I just call him Yokozuma? I think Bret Hart called him that at one time. Anyway, no, he would have called him the Yokozuma. That's what he would have called him. But yes, Randy Savage, I mean, it's a popular talking point, but just criminally underutilized for 1993. Would a feud between him and Shawn Michaels have been better? Yeah, probably. But I would have rather had a Savage-Lawler feud because, quite frankly, that's just more up my alley. As they tell us that next week on Raw, Money Inc. will be taking on the Bushwhackers, so we've been spared, but that would actually get turned into Money Inc. versus the Beverly Brothers. Although maybe that was the week after. I don't know. It's all a blur in my head. Even when 1993 WWF wasn't moving at such a breakneck pace where you just didn't remember anything at all. But that is it for WWF Monday Night Raw from April 5, 1993. Elsewhere this week on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they take a look at the Brawl to End It All from the WWF 1984, which I'm glad that they did because I forever get that confused with the War to Settle the Score. I can never remember which one was in which time frame. And you'd think that the Brawl to End It All would be after the War to Settle the Score simply because the Brawl to End, the word end, is in there, so you think that would be the finale to it. The War to Settle Score wasn't even the end of it either, because WrestleMania was 4, 5, 6 weeks after that. So Brawl to End It All is the July 84 MSG show with Wendy Richter versus Fabulous Moolah, the match that aired on MTV. Now, on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, Mike Crockett, Brian Malonis, and Brian Fury. By the way, Brian Malonis recently re-signed with Ring of Honor for another year, so congratulations to him. They welcome in local independent legend in New England, Dukes Dalton. And that's worth listening to just for the time that he was backstage at a WWF show, or WWE show, it probably was at that point, and Vince McMahon's reaction to him, just walking by him backstage. I had to stop the podcast because I laughed so hard. And Vince's reaction to Dukes Dalton backstage at a WWE show. I don't know what year it was. It's just so funny to me. And, of course, the sportscasters, my good pal Steve Bennett. Do check that out. Subscribe on iTunes, Apple Music. And for that, and for Greetings from Allentown, I ask that you give a 5-star review because, repeat after me, it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. It's now up to 56 reviews on there, which, you know, you want to get that a little bit higher because, you know, all those 5-star reviews, they do add up. And they do help in the algorithm or whatever it is. I don't really know all that much, but You know, there's been about four or five of them in the last month. And I thank you so much for that. And now, what you've been waiting for all week. No, not the return of Eddie Murphy to Saturday Night Live after a very long absence. It's the dramatic return of YouTube Comment Theater. There are quite a few. Actually, not as many as you'd think for a video with 10,000 views. This Monday Night Raw from April 5, 1993. We'll start off with Jonathan Turbide, who says, Virgil, Brawler, Brunzel, Powers, great edition of Monday Night Jobbers. But the best part about it is the indignant reply of Captain N, who says, Virgil was not a jobber. Apparently somebody's been looking up Virgil's cage match results for 1993. Lissy Rudy says, best Raw ever. Yes, the April 5, 1993 is the greatest edition of Monday Night Raw of all time. Daniel Faircloth says, Kim Chi looks like Steve Lombardi, Brooklyn Brawler. And Brooklyn is spelled with two N's. So yes, sharp eye there. Captain N also replies to that. He also portrayed Brooklyn Brawler, Doink the Clown a few times, and even Abe Knuckleball Schwartz. Did anybody ever ask Lombardi, was he like just a really big fan of baseball between that and Abe Knuckleball Schwartz, the Brawler, always wearing the Yankees shirt? I don't know. That'd be something to look into. Jesus Calvillo says, the new generation era. Missed this so much. And yet, I guess this would be the beginning of the new generation. But I don't. Does it get classified until after Hogan leaves? I don't think this really counts. Savini Jason Reviews says, uncut, uncensored, uncut. They overdid that catchphrase. I know they were trying to drive it into people's heads, but after a while, it's just annoying because they were thinking of ways to cram that in. James Fabiano says, WrestleCrap sent me here. For what, I'm not entirely sure. The Damian Demento match? There was nothing on this show that rises to the level of WrestleCrap and the stuff that you know they cover. Randy Curtis says, WWF is a lot better, and WCCW is a lot better. WWE, maybe. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the actual comment. I have no friggin' idea what the hell Randy Curtis was trying to say, so I'm going to wrap it there for YouTube Comment Theater. I think one of the reasons why that doesn't have as many comments is anything from the classic era in the 80s, like it's particularly 84 to 89, just gets a ton of comments on YouTube, I've noticed. I do have one more recurring weekly segment that I do on this program, and I'm going to approach it with great reluctance considering what happened on the last show. Yes, it is time for Vinny Vegas Corner. I say reluctantly because I went 0-3 last week for the first time this season. And it's particularly embarrassing because I'm cherry-picking three games. So you think that I'm picking the three that I'm the most confident in. It was a bad week for me overall, but considering that I'm cherry-picking them. But sometimes I really don't. Sometimes I just want something to talk about, like this Saturday game. Yes, thank God for the return of Saturday NFL, even if it's just for 1 week. It's the Houston Texans going into Tampa Bay to take on the Buccaneers, trying to win the AFC South title. The Houston Texans are. Tampa is red hot. They've won four in a row, but I'm not inclined to trust either one of these teams. I'm not talking about the Texans. They never blow anybody out, and they strike me as a real Jekyll and Hyde team. It's like Deshaun Watson and the 46 Dwarfs, or whatever you want to call them. But you don't want to trust Jameis Winston either, because dude has like 25 interceptions in an era where the best quarterbacks are routinely under 10 for an entire season. But hey, Tampa Bay, they're in the top five in the NFL in scoring offense. So what are you going to believe? It's interesting that a 7-7 team is a 3-point underdog at home to the Houston Texans. Now, Houston's got Tennessee coming up, even though they just played them last week, an interesting quirk of the schedule. Houston can clinch the division by winning this week, which is to say, I don't trust the Houston Texans at all, even against Jameis Winston, so I'm going to take the points. 3 points, Tampa Bay at home against the Houston Texans. Then I'm going to go back to the well once again out in Denver on Sunday afternoon. Denver Broncos favored by 6.5 over the Detroit Lions. This is more of the Detroit Lions are freaking horrible. I've seen nothing from them since Thanksgiving that indicates that they even give even the slightest of shits about winning a game the rest of this year. It's looking like they're going to end up 3-12-1. They got some guy that they keep calling Blow at quarterback because it kind of describes his play, but it's actually pronounced Blow, so it seems. Matthew Stafford deserves better than this, which is probably why a good thing. I would say it's a good thing that he's injured, but he has, like, broken bones in his back, which sounds horribly painful, even more so than acid reflux. And Drew Locke is clearly the future of the National Football League at the quarterback position, so I'm going to take the Denver Broncos, favored by 6.5. It feels like a lot, but I just don't see Detroit, scoring more than 14 points in this game, and I think Denver will get to 20. Now watch, there'll be a friggin' blizzard in the Rockies this weekend. And finally, in a rematch of one of the weirdest games in the NFL this season, the Cleveland Browns hosting the Baltimore Ravens. The Ravens are favored by 10 in Cleveland. Now, if you recall, in September, Cleveland beat the Ravens in Baltimore by over 20 points. Total blowout. They kind of ran away with it in the fourth quarter. This just strikes me as a revenge game for Baltimore. They can clinch home field through the AFC playoffs with a win. 10 points, considering how Baltimore's been blowing out other teams and the revenge that they might be out for in this case, and the fact that Freddie Kitchens is still the coach of the Cleveland Browns at this point, and they looked terrible in Arizona last week, I will lay the 10 with Baltimore at Cleveland, alongside Denver laying 6.5 at home against Detroit, and Tampa Bay getting 3 points against Houston at home on Saturday at 1 o'clock. Vinny Vegas Corner, week 16 in the NFL. Now, next week, we got an episode of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling from February 26, 1983. And that is in the final weeks leading up to the first Jim Crockett Promotion Super Show called Final Conflict, which is in March of 1983. Kind of set a template for what was to come with Starrcade later in the year. So, kind of an interesting time in Jim Crockett Promotions and in the NWA in general. And finally, I want to thank you for listening to the program this week, and I would be remiss if I did not wish you a very Merry Christmas, because it's just occurred to me that Christmas is next Wednesday, which would be before the next show drops. And I think, well, maybe I should do a Christmas-themed show at some point. I mean, there is an edition of WCW Prime that aired on December 25th in 1995. So the only Christmas that Prime was on the air, there was a show on that night. And one of them dressed up as Santa Claus. You'd think it would be Dusty, but I can't remember who it was because it's been a long time since I've seen that. But maybe I'll do Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer through the eyes of a wrestling fan. I could definitely see that Burl Ives snowman as either Triple H or Vince McMahon, but I'll save my thoughts for that until a later time. So once again, thank you, and do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Talking to me?
I don't think so. No, I think
was he talking
addressing...
to me?
No.